I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Just blocks away from the White House, President Bush, his top economic advisors, and a select group of business supporters and contributors are gathering for a two-day conference on economic policy. This morning, Vice President Dick Cheney had these opening remarks.
As we begin to prepare for a new term with a new Congress about to come to town, this is a good time for us to discuss the major economic task ahead of us.
The meeting comes at a time when the economy is growing, but so is the federal deficit, and job creation remains sluggish. Joining us on the line for a preview, Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Linda, even the pro-Bush Washington Times says that critics are saying that this conference is being held in an echo chamber. Your thoughts on that?
It is kind of appearing to be a love fest. What they're trying to do is shift the focus of their economic agenda from the messengers to the actual message. Nobody I've talked to expects any big news to come out of this or any details about policy proposals. This White House does not deal in minute specifics. What they do is throw out broad principles and then tell Congress to work it out amongst themselves and send the president something he can sign.
Okay, there's a wide range of such topics on the table: tax reform, job creation. President Bush will be attending discussions on two topics: limits on awards for medical liability lawsuits and privatizing Social Security. Let's take that one. What's your educated guess as to what the agenda on this topic will be?
Well, this is it's a tricky issue for him and for any president. It's long been known as the third rail of politics. And, you know, with every administration that tries to tackle it, the day of insolvency gets closer. So they're making that case again, and they're trying to do two things at once. One is to deal with the long-term problems of Social Security and also change the way the system works by allowing younger workers to put some of their money into their own private account.
Well, there's no question that the system is going to be broken down the road. I mean, members of both parties agree on that.
Sure.
But economists are saying that, you know, the Bush administration, in trying to privatize a portion of it, is doing it at exactly the wrong time when the deficit's rising.
That's right. And the White House has not been clear about exactly how they would fund the transition costs to a new Social Security system. The transition costs have been placed at between $1 and $2 trillion, and this is already in the face of a record deficit. So the question is, do they try to take it off budget, as they did with the savings and loan settlement, or do they just add it to the deficit and ultimately the national debt, just as you would take on some additional upfront costs when you refinance your house?
Well, that federal deficit now stands at $55.5 billion. Any sense that there might be any kind of detailed plan at the end of this two-day summit that could decrease the deficit, or is that on a back burner somewhere?
No, they're not going to come out with any kind of detailed plans on anything. It's just a sort of a brainstorming session designed in part to show the public that this White House is serious about tackling a variety of domestic issues.
Mm-hmm. The falling dollar, let's remind ourselves, this means that American money doesn't go as far abroad, while here at home, Americans pay more for, say, a Japanese car,
right,
which Japan likes. But tourists, on the other hand, have been flocking to the U.S. to spend their money, which goes further, and for them, it's a boon. The Bush administration has been saying they want to do something about the falling dollar to help Americans. But critics are wondering, do they really, given that it increases trade?
This White House they're a funny ideological mix. I mean, they talk a good game about letting market forces work their wonder, but at the same time, they do very much not like the weak dollar, and they want to do whatever they can to help people and lift all boats. So this is a tricky issue for them. But when push comes to shove, they'll do whatever they can do. I'm not sure what they can do, but they definitely don't want to sit back and just let the chips fall where they may.
Or the dollar fall.
Yeah.
Where it may. Linda Feldman, one last question. Any significance to the fact that this meeting is being held in the Ronald Reagan building?
Well, there's always that reminder of President Bush's ideological godfather. Some people have compared him to President Reagan, and other people bristle at that. They just think that President Bush is not in the same league as Ronald Reagan. But I think there's some obvious significance. It's also interesting, the last time the White House did a big economic summit, they did it in Waco, Texas, away from much of the national press corps. And right now, they're right here in Washington. It's live on C-SPAN television, and So it really is, it's a big public event this time, open to everybody.
More public relations than policymaking.
Probably.
Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Linda, thank you.
All right, thank you.
In the next Congress, abortion is set yet again to become an ideological battleground. In a sign of things to come, a group representing family planning clinics filed a lawsuit this week over a measure regulating abortion services. It was passed by Congress in its waning hours this month. The measure, called the Hyde-Weldon Amendment, withholds federal funding from states which require that health care providers perform, pay for, or provide referrals for abortion services. Abortion foes call it a victory for freedom of conscience. Pro-choice legislators say it's a sneak attack on women's rights. And that's not the only abortion-related matter Congress is preparing to take up next year. They'll also debate whether women who want abortions should be told their fetuses feel pain, a debatable point. And in addition, a new Supreme Court could overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which legalizes abortion. Well, today we'll hear from two lawmakers from different sides of the aisle and different houses of Congress to hear how each side is characterizing the debate. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with abortion critic, Republican Christopher Smith of New Jersey. But we turn now to California Senator Barbara Boxer, simply because she was the first to return our calls. Welcome, Senator Boxer.
Thank you.
And how would you characterize the new 109th Congress? Republicans say they've picked up more anti-abortion votes.
Well, they surely have. And I would say that every woman in this country who believes that a decision on abortion should be a private one should be deeply fearful. Because regardless of the fact that Roe was decided in 1973, it is a grave risk. And Roe was a very moderate decision, but it's not good enough for the ideological right, who I think are bound and determined to put women in prison and doctors in prison if they perform abortions from the first minute of conception.
Well, these are pretty strong statements, and you said
yes.
Women should be afraid. But can you tell us specifically what they should fear legislatively?
Well, what's happening legislatively is that every issue that comes to the floor now that deals with abortion has one purpose, and that is to undermine Roe v. Wade. For example, when there was a bill to outlaw a procedure and not even make an exception for the health of a woman, imagine that, they say that a woman, even if her health is in danger. She may be paralyzed. She may never be able to conceive again. She may get toxic poisoning. Even then, she can't get an abortion. By passing such legislation, which I believe will definitely be ruled unconstitutional, it is sending a message to the court, once the court does change, and it's hanging by a thread now, 5-4, that the Congress agrees that a woman's health doesn't matter. So everything they do is meant to set the stage for making the fetus have equal rights with humans, and for also, and this is really an intriguing issue, now they're starting to pass amendments that would override states' rights to do what the states wanted. For example, the Weldon Amendment, which I was so upset about that they attached to the spending bill.
Let's talk about that. It's called the Hyde-Weldon Amendment, and supporters say that it allows for freedom of conscience regarding abortions. It would withdraw federal funds from states that required hospitals or institutions to provide abortions or information about abortions.
Yes. You see, we already have a very firm conscience clause in place, which I supported, which basically says if any doctor has any conscience problem, that he or she does not have to perform an abortion. But they do have to refer the woman for help. Mm-hmm. Now, they say a doctor doesn't have to refer a woman, and a hospital doesn't have to refer a woman. And if a state says, yes, they do, a state will lose all of its Health and Human Services funding. And I have a promise that I'll be able to have a vote on repeal, but I have no certainty of prevailing, and then the House is so anti-choice, they probably won't act anyway.
Do you think it will pass?
Well, I don't know. See, what they like to do is they sneak these things through in the dark of night, and they have the votes. There's no doubt about it. But the point that I'm going to fight on is, regardless of how you feel about a woman's right to choose, most of the colleagues that I know are always arguing states have a right to do what they want. And this would, you know, basically punish states for doing what they think is right to a woman. I'll give you another example. There's a federal law that says that if a woman or a man or anybody comes into a hospital in an emergency situation, they have to be stabilized, okay? This law would say if a woman walked into a hospital, let's say bleeding from a botched abortion, that that hospital could actually turn her away and she could die. That's what Weldon does. So this Weldon Amendment is a radical amendment, and it's very dangerous. And, you know, we have to throw ourselves in front of this legislative truck. And even when we do, if we lose the court, we're really in trouble. That's why these Supreme Court appointments are so crucial.
And we're going to get some response to your thoughts. But just one other, the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act, we'll be speaking to one of the co-authors in a moment. It requires that women seeking abortions after 5 months be told that a fetus can feel pain. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, sure. This is Congress playing doctor. And now all of us are going to vote to write a script for doctors to tell a woman who's lying on their table. Look, I believe that regardless of what kind of surgery a person is having, whether it's a vasectomy for a man or tying your tubes as a woman or an abortion or anything else that you may be having, a cancer operation, doctors should use all of their training and all of their competence and tell you every ramification of the operation. But for Congress to start writing a script and becoming, you know, the scientific last word on these things is outrageous.
Senator Boxer, do you think that Roe v. Wade is going to be overturned? Senate Democrats may be able to pass another non-binding resolution supporting Roe v. Wade, as you did last year, but it's never passed the House. Do you think Roe v. Wade itself is going to be overturned?
Certainly it will be overturned if George Bush has his way and gets an anti-choice justice on, replacing a pro-choice justice. And, you know, we don't know how that's going to play out. We don't know which justices are going to be coming up for appointment. We don't know who he's going to nominate. And I would just hope that the people of America will weigh in on this. Their rights are on the line. Their health is on the line. Their lives are on the line. I'm old enough to remember the days before Roe when women died. And, you know, I would think that government, at the minimum, should do no harm. And this is a harmful trend. And I can only say that I intend to work overtime. I won my election with the largest margin in California history for any senator. People knew exactly where I stood. I ran ads on the fact that Roe could be overturned. I got sent back the resounding vote. And I intend to work as hard as I can to protect the women of this country.
Barbara Boxer, Democratic Senator from California. Senator Boxer, thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, in a minute, we'll continue with New Jersey Republican Congressman Christopher Smith. Now, he is proposing that women who are more than 5 months pregnant and need an abortion be told that their fetuses feel pain, even though the medical community is split on whether that's true. Stay tuned. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our discussion on the prospects for abortion-related legislation in the next Congress. As we just heard, pro-choice Democrats like California Senator Barbara Boxer say there will be a steady chipping away at the status quo on abortion, leading possibly to an overturning of the Supreme Court decision that legalized it. Well, let's take a view from the other side of the aisle. We turn now to Christopher Smith, Republican congressman from New Jersey. Welcome, Congressman.
Robin, thank you very much for having me on. Appreciate
it. And we'd love to get some of your responses to Senator Boxer's views. Let's start with the Hyde-Weldon Amendment. We should recap that this prohibits federal dollars to states that require hospitals or other organizations to give information about or perform abortions. Critics, including Senator Boxer, say that this violates states' rights. But also, 45 states already have a conscience law that allows doctors to opt out of abortions. So what's the necessity of this amendment?
Well, frankly, the Hyde Amendment and Hyde-Weldon is all about prohibiting discrimination against healthcare providers, and that includes the healthcare networks. We have found all across the country where there's mergers and acquisitions that organizations like Planned Parenthood and other abortion rights organizations have stepped into the fray to say, unless you provide a venue to do abortions, you're not going to have this merger or acquisition. This is a conscience clause. That's all this is. Hyde Weldon is all about saying that just like individual doctors and nurses have consciences in order to be able to say no to the killing of an unborn child, so should a group of people who happen to form a healthcare network.
Well, I want you to get you to as many points as possible
Sure.
here. And let's move to the act that you actually co-sponsored with Kansas Senator Sam Brownback. It's the Unborn Child Awareness Act. We mentioned
Yes.
that as well, saying that a woman at a certain, I think, 20 weeks after conception has to be notified that her fetus can feel pain
Right.
if she decides to go forward with an abortion. What is this based on?
Well, this is based on a number of scientific studies, including the work of Dr. Sonny Anand, who's a pediatrician at the University of Arkansas for medical sciences. He has literally written the book on it. He, like others, have realized that even when you're doing prenatal surgery, that unborn children can feel pain. They feel it more acutely between 20 and 32nd weeks gestation, probably 2 to 4 times more than anyone else will. This says that the woman would be told that she has the option of getting anesthesia so that the baby doesn't suffer.
Well, Congressman Smith, as you well know, there's a big Yes. debate in the medical community about the point at which fetuses might feel pain. But the other point is that when you say, why would someone not want a mother to protect a fetus from pain, some of the critics of your legislation aren't saying that at all. What they're saying is that it should be a decision between a woman and her doctor, that Congress shouldn't be legislating science or legislating medical information, that that's something that a woman and her doctor can decide.
Robert, we're taking the best available science, and I have yet to see any reputable scientist say that the child does not feel pain and does not feel it as acutely as we're asserting in this legislation.
Let's take a look at another act that's under consideration, the Child Custody Protection Act, a
Yes.
bill that makes it a federal crime to circumvent state parental consent laws by taking a minor to another state for an abortion. Some of the criticism of all of this legislation is that it doesn't allow any room for reality. For instance, in this case, perhaps there's a child who's being abused by her own father. Maybe she's been impregnated by her own father. Maybe there's a social worker or somebody working with her who needs to help her in that case. And in other words, in not every case is the parent the best one to be confided in. And this legislation and these provisions don't leave room for those kinds of cases.
Well, they do, frankly, because most states have judicial bypass where there might be a dysfunctional family or an incestuous relationship. But they're exceptions. They are not the rule, but they are provided for. So judicial bypass is an issue that we all recognize and understand and appreciate. But a minor who's 15 years old certainly is not helped in her mental or physical health when she is encouraged to get a secret abortion in a nearby state, and that happens in my state of New Jersey. The New Jersey abortion mills advertise in the yellow pages abortion clinics, no parental involvement necessary. Come on over to New Jersey in Pennsylvania where they have a parental involvement statute.
Congressman Smith, we've covered that story, and you're obviously
Sure.
passionate on this issue. I just want to get you to the broader picture.
Sure.
How are you, who are anti-abortion advocates in Congress and in the Senate now, how are you feeling? Where do you feel you are in this fight?
Robert, we consider ourselves to be human rights advocates who believe that the unborn child, boy or girl, regardless of their race, are precious and need to be protected.
Do you think
and birth is really just an event that happens to each and every one of us? It's not the beginning of life.
I guess what I was getting to, do you think that you are going to overturn Roe v. Wade?
My hope is eventually. I think it's still incremental. I think most people realize that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. It was the Supreme Court itself said, we need not resolve the difficult question of when human life begins. Well, that is the question.
But what about the polls? Let me just ask you about a couple.
Sure.
In one conducted by the Associated Press, it was reported that 59% of the respondents said President Bush should nominate a Supreme Court justice who would uphold Roe v. Wade. That's 59%. Only 31% said he should select a justice who would overturn it. Then I should point out there's another CBS poll just about a month ago show that 44% of Americans believed that there should be stricter limits on abortions. 34% said abortions should be generally available. This is not a landslide. This is not a mandate.
Again, you know, civil rights in the early 60s, particularly in some parts of the country, if you took a poll and held your finger to the wind and said, we're going to decide human justice based on the latest poll, you would have found that we would have never enacted the 1964 Civil Rights Act. This is all about human rights and protecting unborn children from violence and likewise protecting women from the violence of abortion.
Republican Congressman Christopher Smith from New Jersey speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Congressman Smith, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Robin.
And a reminder, earlier we spoke with pro-choice Senator Barbara Boxer to get a sense of the roiling debate ahead in Congress on this issue. As always, we welcome your thoughts on this or any other issue on the show. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Tomorrow on Here and Now, terrorism in Spain. The separatist group known as ETA is once again making its voice heard loud and clear. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Republicans in Washington state say they are now absolutely convinced that Democratic officials are trying to steal the gubernatorial election. Since the November 2nd election, Republican Dino Rossi has held onto a very slim lead, sometimes as few as 42 votes. But Rossi's lead was thrown into doubt this week when officials in King County, a Democratic stronghold that includes Seattle, said they would count more than 500 ballots that had earlier been rejected. And that could benefit the Democrat, Christine Gregoire. David Postman covers politics for the Seattle Times. And David, these 500 ballots recently discovered are absentee ballots. Why are officials now saying they should be counted?
Well, what happened with those is that it has to do with trying to match signatures. And every voter has a signature on file in the county auditor's office when they register to vote. And the law says when you submit an absentee ballot, the signature on your envelope has to be matched to the signature on the voter registration file. They do that by computer. Now they scan the signatures, mm-hmm. and it's all on a computer screen. Somehow those voters' signatures were never scanned. They were set aside. It turned out that one of those was the chairman of the King County Council, very prominent Democrat, clearly a registered valid voter. He discovered his name on that list, and that's how it was discovered that these were all in error.
Well, now what happens with those votes?
Well, today they will go before the County Canvassing Board, which is a three-member panel that has the ultimate power to decide which of those ballots get counted. Not all of them will be. Some probably are meant to be invalid. And then once the canvassing board decides that they're valid, they'll go back into the counting room, and the hand counting team will look at each one of them.
Now, yeah, we should say there's been a machine recount. Rossi held on his lead after that. And now there's, as you said, a statewide hand count. When do you expect that to conclude?
Right before Christmas, probably. I think the best case would be the 22nd, next Wednesday, but nothing in this count has gone, best case. So that's why I figure maybe a little bit past that.
Okay. Now, the state Supreme Court has also gotten involved. The Democratic Party launched a lawsuit asking that rejected votes be considered in a recount. The state Supreme Court ruled yesterday that votes that had been previously rejected need not be included in the final tally. But that raises the question, does that include these 561 ballots that were erroneously rejected?
No. What the Democrats wanted was they wanted every county, all 39 counties, to be mandated, to be ordered to reconsider this. The court said, no, we're not going to do that. But each county still maintains the discretionary power. So in the case of King County, they have 500 now, almost 570 ballots in question. They've decided that those are worthy of a second look.
So, David, what's the chance that this whole issue is going to go to the legislature, which raises some odd questions about politicians appointing a governor? What are some of the possible outcomes?
It's a slim chance, but, again, a lot of things that have happened since Election Day no one could have predicted, so it's certainly a possibility. There is a line in the state constitution that says contested elections shall be decided by the legislature. Democrats started out raising that issue and said that that means they could take a disputed election right to the legislature in January when the new legislature is seated. The new legislature is controlled all both chambers by Democrats. Both sides say it's possible. Can't imagine the Republicans would do it. I also think it's unlikely Democrats would in the end, in part because their candidate, Christine Gregoire, said she doesn't want that to happen.
How are people in Washington handling this?
Well, they're clearly losing patience if my telephone calls and emails are any indication. Republicans particularly, given that their candidate won the initial count, won the machine recount, have very little patience for things like these discovered ballots in King County.
But I'm wondering, Democrats across the country are still feeling that many of their ballots were conveniently lost in other cities, so this must be fueling that, you know, those theories.
You're absolutely right, and in fact, that's what fueled the fundraising for the Democrats. They needed to raise a lot of money, more than $700,000, to start this hand recount, and a lot of it came from outside of Washington State. John Kerry donated, the Democratic National Committee, Move On Political Action Committee raised more than $400,000 in less than 24 hours. This is an issue that resonates with Democrats around the country in a way that I frankly, I'm a little surprised by.
Dave Postman writes for the Seattle Times. Dave, keep us posted.
You bet. Thanks, Robin.
Mahmoud Abbas, the man who will most likely be the next Palestinian president, has called for an end to the armed uprising against Israel. The so-called Second Intifada erupted in September of 2000 and has cost some 1,000 Israeli and 3,000 Palestinian lives. Joining us for a quick Mideast update is Greg Myrie. He's Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. And Greg, Mahmoud Abbas made these comments in an interview in a London newspaper. It has broad readership across the Arab world. What did he say exactly?
He said what he has said in softer tones before, which is the armed uprising, the violence against Israel for the past 4 years has hurt the Palestinians and they have to stop it. Now, this is something Palestinians have said on occasion, but never with as a leader has said this and said it so clearly as Mahmoud Abbas said in this statement.
And the significance of the timing, according to most?
It comes just a month after Yasser Arafat's death. It's the clearest statement and intention of a new strategy or a new approach since Mr. Arafat's death. Mr. Arafat would make perfunctory condemnations of suicide bombings, but never came out and said something this clearly. This is a position which Mr. Abbas has known to have had for a while, but for him to come out and say it this clearly at what looks to be the beginning of his leadership in the Palestinian areas is a very significant development.
Well, this combines with another story that you wrote in today's New York Times. You report that Palestinian radio and television is sounding and looking very different since the death of Yasser Arafat. For those who don't get to hear Palestinian radio, just what are some of the comments from before and how have they changed?
Well, for years and years, and certainly during the past 4 years of fighting here in the Mideast, Palestinian television has been very, very harshly critical of Israel. It would be in news commentary where the news readers might describe the savage occupation forces when talking about Israeli troops. It might be a very, very harsh anti-Semitism in the language used by Muslim clerics when they deliver their Friday sermon. It would be video clips that would repeat endlessly around the clock showing dead and maimed Palestinians. So this is the kind of thing we've just seen constantly for 4 years. Israel says this is incitement that has encouraged further violence.
And the change. And how is it now?
Yes, in the past month, we've seen a much more moderate tone. Some of the preachers, the Muslim preachers, have spoken about the need for reconciliation and tolerance for the other, as they say. We've seen the language has been toned down considerably. So this again, is a very significant development. It also seems to be coming from Mr. Abbas.
Yeah, a shifting tone from the Palestinians, and we'll check in with you constantly for more as we head to more news in that region. Greg Myrie, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Hanukkah, the Jewish festival of lights commemorating the rededication of the temple in Jerusalem in 165 BC, ends at sundown today. But before the Hanukkah music is put away till next year, one last treat. Woody Guthrie's daughter, Nora, recently discovered dozens of Jewish-themed lyrics that the Dust Bowl balladeer had written but never set to music. She asked the Klezmatics, a New York City klezmer band, to compose melodies for the words. The result is the Klezmatics' new CD, Woody Guthrie's Happy Joyous Hanukkah. Lead vocalist Lawrence Lamberg brings us some of Woody Guthrie's Hanukkah compositions.
Hey to the nights of Hanukkah, happy joyous Hanukkah. Hey to the days and hey to the nights, happy joyous Hanukkah.
Woody Guthrie came to writing songs about Jewish holidays and about Jewish life in Brooklyn through being married to Marjorie Mazia, who was a dancer with the Martha Graham Company. Her mother was a well-known Yiddish poet and songwriter named Eliza Greenblatt, often characterized as a woman Jewish troubadour. A Jewish woman troubadour wrote lots of wonderful songs and poems and was a staunch Zionist and advocate for human rights. In that respect, Woody identified with her as a writer and as a human rights person, and they kind of had this professional relationship critiquing each other's work. He was inspired to study Jewish history and write songs about Hanukkah, for instance.
Round and round my Hanukkah tree, round and round I go. Round and round my Hanukkah tree because I love you so. Round and round my Hanukkah tree, round and round I go. Round and round I'll hold your hand because you love me so.
He definitely is writing from the point of being somewhat of an outsider. So the songs are speaking from his own experience there. So, for instance, he has a song called Hanukkah Tree. Now, a lot of people would kind of ruffle their feathers a little bit because there's this whole kind of thing about how Hanukkah is not the Jewish Christmas and it's really a separate thing and it's really a lesser Jewish holiday and so the Jews don't have a Hanukkah tree. However, apparently the Guthrie family had some sort of a shrub and it wasn't a Hanukkah bush, which is kind of the stereotypical thing that Jews supposedly have to be the equivalent of a Christmas tree. And they didn't have a Christmas tree, but they had a Hanukkah tree. So they're all kind of his own quirky take on Hanukkah.
It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah, round and around. Honey cake, Hanukkah, eat them down. Latkes and goody things all over town. It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah time.
His personality really, really comes through in the lyrics. I mean, the way he says things are very specifically his. In addition to the fact that they're kind of a quirky take on Hanukkah, I think that you could tell that they were his words. No one else would write particular things come up with turns of phrase like Hanukkah, Hanukkah. It's Hanukkah, Hanukkah, round and round. Honey cake, Hanukkah, eat them down. Latkes and goody things all over town. I mean, it's not the sort of thing that most people would, the way most people would sing about Hanukkah.
My name is King Cyrus. My order I give. You Jews can go back to your home to build your holy temple again in the land of Palestine.
The Many and the Few, it's based on what I believe is an Irish folk tune. The song, it's an epic poem about the story of Hanukkah. And again, it's a very Woody Guthrie take on it. So it doesn't sound like these kind of hackneyed English Jewish things that you hear where people have songs about the Hanukkah story, about, you know, that all sound kind of like the Ten Commandments, that kind of, you know, very grand kind of language. It's very eloquent, but at the same time, it's very plain spoken. He has a particularly wonderful insight into the troubles of humans, and his songs are so, you know, uplifting, even if they're about some sort of a depressing subject or a serious subject. He just has a certain way of making you feel good and human.
As the king of Syria and Palestine, Antiochus the IV, you'll stand.
Lawrence Glamberg is the lead vocalist for The Klezmatics. Their new CD is called Woody Guthrie's Happy Joyous Hanukkah. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
My name is Hannah, my firstborn son.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Did you know that nearly 24,000 new cookbooks were released around the world last year? The chairman of the Gourmand Awards alone receives about 5,000 books a year to review. So many recipes, so little time. But our food critics have done the research for you, and they're here now with the books they consider the best of the crop. Joining us in the studio, Here and Now's food guru, Scott Haas. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Robin.
And our very own Here and Now chef and cookbook author, Kathy Gunst. Hi, Kathy.
Hello, Robin.
And so I can't believe how many cookbooks there are. Plus, looking at the ones you've brought in, you need small trailers just to carry them. They're huge. So let's start with you, Kathy. What was your favorite all-time release this year?
My favorite book is called The Breath of a Wok. It's by a woman named Grace Young, and it is a book devoted to a single subject, and that is the wok. And it sounds like it's potentially tedious, you know, an entire book about a single piece of kitchen equipment. It is so fascinating. It's about the history of the wok. It's how to shop for a wok, how to season a wok, woks around the world, and then, of course, fabulous recipes. But the most interesting part of the book is that, for me, I had never heard of this before. She introduces the concept of something called wok hay. This concept that if you get a wok hot enough, what happens is the minute the food hits the heat, the magic happens. The food cooks quickly and the flavors are sealed in. And since I've read this book, I've been cooking in my wok and I've been finding that everything tastes better because I was never getting the wok hot enough.
There you go.
So it's been completely an eye-opener for me. I can't say enough good about it. I was so impressed.
Well, okay. What is it again?
The Breath of a Wok.
The Breath of a Wok.
Beautiful title.
Okay, there's one for Kathy. Scott, top that.
Well, I have discovered in my dotage, Robin, that I really I don't like to cook. I prefer to eat, and I prefer what happens when you cook. I prefer to have friends over, and we drink wine and some martinis, and we hang out. So I'm looking for cookbooks that are low maintenance. And the big cookbook event of the year was the Gourmet Cookbook. And what's wonderful about this is the ease of the recipes. I mean, I made a turkey meatloaf the other night that took literally start to finish, except for when it was in the oven, 12 minutes.
Really?
And it tasted great.
This is, of course, authored by Ruth Reichel.
She's the editor, and these recipes are coming from all over, and it says over 60 years in the making. And there's really a lot of classics in here, but also what's lovely about it, there's less cream, there's less butter, there's more Asian ingredients, there's more Latin American ingredients, there's more cookings from African American tradition. And it's not a question of diversity or political correctness. It's the fact that the country has changed and the recipes reflect that change.
So, Scott, can we throw away all our old issues of Gourmet magazine if we buy this book?
Well, do what you like.
It's a fat book.
I'm not throwing away Joy of Cooking either, because there's no more fun book for, you know, the turkey gravy at Thanksgiving. But this is really fun. What I like about it is how easy it is to use.
Well, and it does look like a huge, big yellow dictionary.
It's huge.
Can you pass it over? I want to see this.
Yeah, it weighs, I'd say, about 7 pounds.
Oh, wow. It does, and it's beautiful. And I look inside, and I see that this, the Gourmet Cookbook, doesn't have a lot of pictures, whereas yours, the Walk Book, does. What is important to you when you pick out a
I have a another book? Cookbook here loaded with pictures. I mean, there's cookbooks that are sort of what I think of as food pornography or the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue of cookbooks. I mean, they're gorgeous things to look at, but you're not really going to cook the dishes in them.
Okay. Well, Kathy, your next book.
Well, it's a good lead-in because my next book does not have pictures. It's called Marcella Says, and it's by the legendary Italian chef, cookbook author, Marcella Hazan. I first met this woman 25 years ago. I was lucky enough to study with her in Bologna, Italy. Mm-hmm. She is to Italian food what Julia Child is to French food. She is the master, and each one of her books, she swears, is the last book. She's now in her 80s, living in Florida. And if this is her last book, it's a wonderful last book because it's really written like a master class. What has always impressed me the most about Marcella Hazan is her ability to write a recipe so that if you read the introduction, you don't really need to read the recipe because you have a concept in your head of what it's all about. It's explicit. It's clear. And I can visualize this food without a single photograph. There's a swordfish scallopini with garlic, parsley, and lemon juice. There's a fennel and orange salad. Mm. I think her food maybe has gotten a bit lighter. There's still cream. There's still pasta. But if you read this book, you will learn. It's like spending a week with her. You will learn about the nuances behind recipes, the idea of a technique, how long to cook pasta, how to pair sauces with certain pasta.
Stop.
And you're getting hungry.
So, I know. What's it called again?
It's called Marcella Says, and all scattered throughout the book with each recipe and each essay, there'll be an insert that says Marcella Says, and there'll be a hint. And it's really very well written. Again, concise. Mm. And that's very appealing in a cookbook. There's so many cookbooks that have gorgeous photographs, but ultimately it's just a lot of fuss.
Well, I was going to ask you, Kathy, you cook from these cookbooks to test them out. Do you ever come across one that's really heralded, but the recipes just don't—they just don't work?
Ever? Are you kidding?
All the time.
It's such a rarity to find a book, and that's the two that I've chosen so far. I feel this way about where I feel that I trust that every recipe in these books work. They've been tested and retested. And if a recipe doesn't work in a cookbook, it doesn't matter how beautiful it is. It's useless to you.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, that's what it's there for.
Well, no, this is really funny. I see that you have both chosen the same third.
Yeah, we didn't talk about this either. There's a third book we have here, Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food. And what's wonderful about this book is that it tells the history of New York City through its food. I love books like this because it's got beautiful photographs, it's got good recipes, and it also tells a story because, frankly, on a nightly basis, most people don't use cookbooks to cook. They cook their regular dishes. And this is a book that you can learn about New York City through its recipes.
I think it's really like a love letter to New York. It starts over 100 years ago, and it goes up to the Jewish influences on New York cuisine, the Italian, the Romanian. He really has covered the gamut. And he is also a very funny writer and a very clear writer. There are wonderful vintage menus in here, old photos of seeing, the first automat. So much in food happens in New York City that to read a book about the history of New York City food is really to read about food in general. Mm-hmm. And Arthur Schwartz, who was a radio personality for years and a columnist for the New York Post, he does it beautifully.
Arthur Schwartz's New York City Food. And do I see one last beautiful book?
Yeah, this
there?
Is exquisite.
You couldn't put that in the kitchen while you were cooking.
I know, it's really gorgeous. It's called Bouchon. It's Thomas Keller's book, Thomas Keller being the chef of French Laundry in Per Se. This is his bistro. And what he says in the introduction, he jokes, he said, Bouchon was opened up so I could have a place to eat after I had finished cooking at the French Laundry. Because most chefs, when they finish cooking at these high-end restaurants, they don't eat their food. I mean, they'll taste it. But when they want to sit down, they want to have a bistro meal, steak and frites or some rabbit casserole or something really good, simple and hearty. And this is a classic book about wonderful French bistro dishes.
Name it again?
Bouchon. And that's the name of the restaurant that he has. One of them is in Napa Valley. The other he just opened in Las Vegas this year.
Beautiful. Well, we can't let you go without acknowledging books that we think were pretty good that were published this year. And they're yours. Scott, yours came out last spring. It's called?
Are We There Yet?
Perfect Family Vacations and Other Fantasies.
Absolutely.
About traveling the world and the world's restaurants with your family. And Kathy, yours is a beautiful cookbook. You put it together in collaboration with the men who founded Stonewall Kitchen up in York, Maine. The name again?
Harvest. Stonewall Kitchen Harvest.
Celebrating the bounty of the season. We highly recommend them both. And thank you both for coming in with this. Now we need some sort of a
wheelbarrow
vehicle to get
You don't need the gym
out.
Anymore. You just have to lift cookbooks.
That's right. Here now, Scott Haas and Kathy Guns. For more information on their picks for favorite cookbooks, check out our website, here-now.org. is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.